No, because these guys, they, you know, they look at you. I mean, Joe Jordan, you know, looked to me. It was a look of terror that came across my face. You know, the guy was an imposing guy.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the CSI Football Podcast, where we embark on a forensic delve into a particular season of football, usually with a tartan tint. I'm your host, Ian Stephen. And for today's episode, we meet a man who was once described as having a voice akin to being strapped to a dentist chair with slightly warmed caramel being poured directly into your ear canals. It's BBC commentator Paul Mitchell. Paul, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm very well. Thanks for having me along. Appreciate it.
Now, I need to make this clear. There's usually a lot of forced bonhomie in these kind of interviews, but we really don't like each other. It's genuine friction that we have. It's like two Karens circling the last customer complaint form in a cost-effective German-based supermarket. It's that level of...
Yeah, I mean, I've had to ask to have you barred from various football grounds in the past, which has been relatively successful, so I can't complain too much.
That's only fair. So I think the first thing to ask, Paul, is where were you born and brought up, and what were your sporting passions when you were young?
I'm an Edinburgh boy, born and raised. I stay within 5 minutes walk of my primary school, 25-minute walk in my secondary school, so I've never gone particularly far. My passion, as was probably the same for most kids growing up in the 70s and 80s, football, just obsessed by football. Mainly, you know, because you listened to it on the radio and you read about it. There wasn't a great deal of football on the television at the time. Big games were special games, Scotland, England, Scottish Cup final, that kind of thing. And then when I got to secondary school, I branched out and played a little bit of rugby. So they were the main sports that I played growing up.
Now, you don't have to answer this question if you don't want to, because as a commentator, you're impartial. But was there a particular football club that you perhaps had affections for when you were growing up?
The first game I went to was Meadowbank Thistle. That's where my dad would take me, off to the Commonwealth Stadium. My dad was a Hearts fan. But he was also going and witnessing a lot of the trouble that was going on at Hearts games and Hibs games at that time. So decided to bed us in with the love of all things Meadowbank Thistle, which was great. It was great fun just to be at professional football games and watch guys playing at the top of their game. And as an Edinburgh boy, obviously one of the big two, and obviously leaned towards Hearts.
It's quite interesting because there's various ways where you can actually accurately date somebody. And in Scottish football circles, it's what name you effectively give to either Ferranti Thistle, Meadowbank Thistle, or now Livingston. That's the kind of age group that you kind of succinctly fall into.
Yeah, I think it was probably about 74, 75 that I started to go along to watch Meadowbank. And it was just great fun. It was just a fun thing to do, you know. It was just, as a small kid, going to any football game was big, and it was just brilliant fun. You know, I remember seeing Stuart Kennedy playing in goals for Forfar. I remember seeing great free kick to beat Stranraer 2-0. I've got great memories of those days.
So how did the move from being a football fan into somebody who wanted to talk about football for a living come about? What were the early origins of your commentary?
Well,
desires.
You'll be like me, and you were probably convinced you were going to captain Scotland at a World Cup finals, because that's what we believe. The harsh reality then kicks in when you realise you're not good enough. I spent a season at Tynecastle Boys Club. The two best players there were Brian Welsh, who went on to play for Hibs and Dundee United, and Scott Crabb, who went on to play with Hearts. Even as a 15, 16-year-old kid, watching these guys play and the games they were playing in, I mean, I simply knew I wasn't good enough at that point, because they were just so much better. And you could tell every time they went on a field, they were so much better. So I decided to pursue my other love, which at the time was radio. I loved radio. So I decided to join the Edinburgh Hospital Broadcasting Service, went through their recruitment process, got let in. And, you know, one of the things they did was sport. So I got involved in the sporting side of things. And went from there. I really, really enjoyed it. If I wasn't going to be good enough to play, I wasn't tall enough to be a referee. At 5'6", you need a little bit more presence on a football field or a rugby field.
What? That was a thing. There was a height. Referees.
You watched all the referees and most of the good ones. I mean, certainly if you were going to have to come up through the junior ranks, being skinny and 5'6" was never going to cut it. Certainly with my temperament. So I decided that I was going to go into the broadcast world and just see where it took me.
Can you imagine me as a referee at my size? Every two minutes, having to call a timeout and go for a
walk. Yeah, but at least they wouldn't be trying to hit you.
Well, what did you then have to do to get yourself noticed by more commercial channels?
What happened was Radio 2 used to run an amateur sports commentator of the year competition, which you basically, you made a cassette, sent it away, and they came back. And on both occasions, I reached the Scottish final. Now, don't get me wrong, Ian, there was probably only about 10 folk entering. And I went through to Glasgow to the BBC twice. One was judged by the late, great Alistair Alexander. The other was judged by Derek Ray. I didn't win it either time, but I was given an introduction to the BBC Sports Department. Somebody reckoned that I was good enough, and they got in touch, and I went and had a chat with them, and they trained me up to be a reporter. So in November, it was November 91, I got sent to my first game, which was Hibs against Falkirk, which was a 2-2 draw. Having been trained by Jim Spence and Bill Mould, two of the reporters of the day. And basically that was the start of my broadcasting career. Most Saturdays I would get a game, usually at Easter Road or at Tynecastle, occasionally at Meadowbank. Sometimes it would be outside of Edinburgh at Falkirk or something like that. And my career just started from there. You know, you went through to the end of season do, you then met people and, you know, you started to expand your network. And yeah, that's how it grew.
I had some very kind of rude awakenings in my fledgling career getting into behind-the-scenes stuff with football. Was there any kind of early lessons that you received about what you'd got yourself into?
Yeah, one of the things the BBC used to do was on a Friday. This was different times. I mean, you're talking the 90s. It's not the media coverage that it is now. You know, I used to get sent in my lunch hour because I worked for Standard Life to either Easter Road or Tynecastle to pick up an interview with a manager, be that Joe Jordan or, you know, whoever it was, Alec Miller at Easter Road. And it was that allowed me a little glimpse into the running of a professional football club. It taught you to be there on time. It taught you to be, you know, I was a young kid. I was 22. You know, and all of a sudden I'm interviewing Premier League managers. You learn very quickly that you've got to know what you're talking about. You've got to be well prepared in your questions, you know, because these guys, they look at you. I mean, Joe Jordan, you know, looked to me. It was a look of terror that came across my face. You know, the guy was an imposing guy. You know, Scotland internationalist, played for AC Milan, and suddenly this 22-year-old kid's trying to interview him. So I learned a lot from those. You know, you learn to be polite. You learn to listen to other people, you know, the senior journalists that were around the place.
I don't believe for a second you had to learn to be polite, Paul. You're an absolute gentleman. It flows
in the footballing sense. You know, because you know what it's like in the realms of football. I mean, you've seen people who ask a question in an interview. Somebody's in the middle of replying to it, and then somebody cuts across to another question. And in radio terms, that ruins your answer. So, you know, you've got to be careful in these things. But yeah, I learned a lot simply from going along and chatting to these guys. You know, occasionally you chat with a player, you know, Eamon Bannon, Henry Smith, Keith Wright, people like that. And that just helped me be very gently introduced to the world of football.
You mentioned a very kind of interesting technological term there, Paul. You mentioned the word cassette, which might be alien to some people of younger generations. How different was the technology and also the salubrious sound surroundings of Scottish football when you started compared to what we get now?
So when I started first recording things, you would have a UR reel-to-reel tape machine. So I would go to Tynecastle or Easter Road. Usually by car, not always, sometimes on the bus. You'd record the interview, and then you'd have to go back to the BBC in Queen Street. you'd have to go into a studio and you'd have to link up with someone in Glasgow to play that tape that they could record it at the other end. You know, now you stick a phone in front of someone, you chat to them for 2 minutes, you email the file and your job's done. You know, it's completely different. We had what they called at the time a CUBI, commentator operated outside broadcast unit, and you would carry this hefty thing to the games and you would pray it worked, you know, because you would plug into the telephone lines, which were of the highest quality because they were broadcast quality, and you just hoped that the machine worked. I mean, it's wild now. People broadcast simply just off their internet signal, their phone signal, which is a little bit dodgy. You know, that's not always ideal. But yeah, I mean, the technological advances that have come on. I mean, even stupid little things, Ian. You know, we used to, at Tynecastle or Easter Road, we used to have to bring people up to the point for an interview after the game. So you take them to the press box. And I think it was the main game had started with this crazy thing called a radio mic, where the person just stood at the side of the pitch and did it. And certain teams got used to this. And if you didn't have that, they didn't want to talk to you because they didn't want to have to come up to the back of the stand. You know, why didn't you have this radio mic thing? You know, but now everything's done on your phone.
Was there any games that you went to when you thought, this is too luxurious, they're spoiling me? And was there any games where you went to thinking, I might need to go to the hospital to get a tetanus shot? That was terrible.
I used to love that. I mean, to go to places that were new to you, you know. I mean, Cowdenbeath was always an eye-opener. You know, whether your machine worked or not was a miracle. And then, you know, sort of 10 to 5, once the players had trotted off the pitch, you know, folk were pushing tyres out and, you know, cars were revving up and getting ready to go, you know, for the stock car racing. So that was always was interesting. East Fife, I remember going to the old East Fife Stadium and they actually had a painted diagonal line or in white paint across the seats that basically said, if you sit on the left-hand side, you've got a restricted view. If you sit on the right-hand side, you're able to see the whole pitch. You know, that's how technical it was. It was a painted white line. It's great.
Can I tell Absolutely. You my Cowdenbeath story? So I'm maybe about 4 or 5 games into my career when I was still at university, asked to go to Cowdenbeath, turned up. First journalist there, and the guy that was at the door welcomed me in said, right, here's your name, you're on the list, press box is just up there, take this. And he hands me a can of insect spray, and I was like, what's this? I we've had a wasp infection, we think we've got rid of most of them, but some of them still might be in the press box. So the press box was like, it was like a little hut, it was enclosed, and I'm just looking at this just like, what? And I had to go into this press box kind of wasp spray in case any attack. And then if that wasn't bad enough, at the end of the game, for some reason, I could not find Craig Levine to interview him because he was the Cowdenbeath manager. And I had to knock on his door. I was like 19 years old and interview one of the most intimidating figures in Scottish football at that time. And I was like maybe the most scared I've ever been. So Cowdenbeath doesn't have good memories for me.
Remember once at Easter Road, there was a big conference in Edinburgh, some Euro conference with a lot of leaders. So they were very, very twitchy. And the press box at that time was at the back of the stand and they discovered not a package, but an unattended bag. So they had to evacuate the stadium. And I remember going on the commentator-operated outside broadcast equipment to say to the studio, look, I'm having to leave now, you know, because we're being thrown out. There's a problem. And it turned out it was the groundsman's sandwiches that he left at the back of the stand. That's how dodgy it was. It was, but yeah, the whole place got evacuated because of the groundsman.
Can you imagine him going back to his wife? Your sandwiches are so bad, darling, they called out the police. Well, so is there? I've got a couple of occasions in my head, and I think you probably do too. But is there any recollections when you were at a match and you slipped out of work mode into fan mode and thought, I can't believe I'm here. This is absolutely awesome.
I think because I'd grown up being taken to likes of Meadowbank or occasionally to Hearts, it was never to the big games. So I think, you know, when Rangers and Celtic or Hibs suddenly appeared at Tynecastle, you know, and I'm there, I was used as a pitch side reporter for some of these games when they were Radio Scotland commentaries, either with David Begg or with Alistair Alexander. And they were the pinch yourself moments, because all of a sudden I'm sitting in the old press box at Tynecastle, which was at the back of the stand built in, you know, watching David Begg, you know, commentate on a football match, you know, and it was, you know, was the Radio Scotland main game of the day. You remember back in the day, radio commentaries didn't start 3 o'clock on a Saturday and you weren't allowed to say where you were. It was the SFA policy. You couldn't review your commentary game till 3:30, which was the most bizarre thing, because everybody knew, depending at where David or Alistair were, that was always going to be the commentary game. But you couldn't actually say that. So they were the sort of early pinch me moments, just being able to sit, you know, with the likes of David Begg, with Billy McNeil, John Gregg, you know, Murdo McLeod, Gordon Smith, just meeting these guys and watching them work was an incredible moment. And yeah, people might think, well, that's not actually watching the game on the field, but watching these guys cover the game was part of the fun for me, because, you know, I watched to see how it was done. And it was just great. I mean, Hearts had a good side at that time. You know, Rangers had some big, big players in the early 90s as well. So it was just a treat to suddenly, from what you've seen on television and heard on the radio, suddenly you're there. It's marvellous.
Is there a season that stands out to you as your favourite to cover? I know it's a long career that you've had, but you do keep detailed records, so you probably could research it.
I'm not sure there's any particular one season. I mean, there's certain memories of being able to sort of cover, you know, Hearts and Hibs in Europe for the first time. You know, watching Hibs play Anderlecht, for example, Hearts play Sparta Prague. Moments like that. I mean, there's been some great title races along the way. And one of my first television, it wasn't my first television game, but it was one of the first, was when the BBC had the contract in the early 2000s. I think Celtic were at Kilmarnock and Rangers played Dunfermline. Whoever won, you know, won the title. You know, Rob McLean was leading the team on BBC One. I was leading the team. I think it was myself and Derek White were on BBC Two. And that sheer excitement of, you know, I could be calling the title game here. You know, if it goes wrong for Rangers, I'm going to be calling the title in what I think would have been my second or third live TV game. You know, so that was quite a thrill. The other thing with that game, that Kilmarnock Celtic game, was there was actually a fire in the BBC trucks. We very nearly didn't make it on air that day. It took a lot of work to get us on air. I think we came on, the teams were already on the field when we came on. You know, can you imagine if we hadn't got on air? It would have been, oh, the conspiracy theories, yeah.
The conspiracy theories. Aye, that Paul Mitchell always well, had this it is in it. For us. He says he supports Medibank, Thistle, but he's really a insert your team from Glasgow.
Well, the good thing is, yeah. Ian, that I've been accused of supporting every team in Scotland, and usually it's when they're playing against your team and your team's getting beat. You know, one of the funniest things that happened to me was somebody actually wrote to complain about a Hearts-Celtic game I did in which, I think it was Henrik Larsson scored a hat-trick. I mean, it was a brilliant hat-trick. I mean, it was tremendous. You know, and how could they put a Celtic supporter on such a game? You can't.
You can't win. What do you think? What do you think the biggest game is that you've ever attended?
I'm not really sure, Ian, that it gets much bigger than doing Italy against Scotland in the San Siro. That's really one of my highlights. It was just an amazing, you know, I grew up watching as much football on telly as I could. So one of the things that we started to get a glimpse of was Football Italia on Channel 4, presented by James Richardson, which you used to get on a Sunday afternoon, when there was very little sport on. So to be able to sit and watch, you know, the matches from Genoa, Milan, Rome, there was just something magical about Italian football. So to be able to go, and I've always had a soft spot for Italy in terms of football. I've not owned many international football jerseys replicas of my time in, but I did have an Italian jersey for such a long time. There's just something about them. So to be able to go to a stadium like the San Siro, which I have to say was a bit of a dump, certainly inside. The dressing rooms were not what you would have expected. They were doing a sort of big period of refurbishment work, and all the hospitality areas, etc., was tremendous. One of the things I always do when I go to stadiums abroad, Ian, is I try to sneak into as many places as I can to see what they're like. You know, a bit of a stadium geek. I love stadiums. So I like to try and get into the dressing rooms. I like to try and get into the referees area. I like to try and get into all the hospitality just to get a feel for what the stadium's like. You know, wander around as many places and parts of it as I can.
Let's hope you never cover the Ladies World Cup, Paul. You get yourself in a lot of trouble. I've been to the San Siro as well. I went as a fan, and I agree with you. Everybody going to the game was carrying a newspaper, which I thought was a bit weird. The only people I'd ever seen carry newspapers to the football was at Partick Thistle, where they were bringing in the Independent so they could do the crossword at halftime. They were all bringing in newspapers. What? This is weird. And it's till I got to the seats, and every single seat was filthy with this kind of black tar over it. And they would put the newspaper down so they'd sit in the newspaper and not sit in the seat, which I found, because San Siro was, it's down as like one of the top 10 stadiums of all time in football, and to see it like that, I was quite surprised.
Yeah, I mean, it's been largely refurbished now, and of course, we don't know how long it has left because they're looking at building another. But it was just one of these iconic places. The other thing with the Italian stadiums that I've found everywhere is, you know, they have these, well, we'd call them fast food vans outside. I mean, they're not quite Michelin star catering, but it's not far off it because everything's so fresh, so beautiful, so lovely. So always after a game that I covered in Italy, make sure you get outside to get to one of these brilliant vendors who, you know, cut you sort of fresh meat, cheese, beautiful baguette, you know, great Italian food, which is a little bit different to some of the fare that's on offer up and down the United Kingdom.
Now, I'm going to debunk a myth here, Paul, because I think a lot of people look at football commentary and think, that's an easy gig, talking about football for a couple of hours, I could do that. But I've seen firsthand that's not the case. So can you explain the amount of work, preparation, dedication that goes in to just covering one game, either live in radio or live in football?
So for every Scottish Premiership side, Ian, I keep my own statistics. So that's games played, who played in them, subs, goal scorers, career history of all players. And I've got all that in a spreadsheet. So whichever game I'm going to do, so I think the last commentary I did was Rangers Ross County. I'll print out all my sheets. I'll then have two sheets of paper that will be in front of me during the game. On the right-hand side, there are my player notes. So when the teams become available, I've used my own Excel information to create a label for every player. I will then put that label onto my sheet in numerical order because that's how my mind works. So I've got the players 1 to 11, so to speak. And then on my other side, on my left-hand side, I've got probably about 100 to 150 pieces of information about the game itself, head-to-head, you know, when they last met, when was the last red card in the game, when was the last hat trick. You know, you're looking for things that are unusual about the fixture. You know, for example, Ross County against Rangers. It was widely known that Ross County had never beaten Rangers. So that was widely known. So how do you go to the next step? How do you find something interesting? Because by the time you start your broadcast, most people will know that. So I managed to uncover the fact that of all the current league clubs in Scotland, there are only two that they've played that they've never beaten. One is Rangers, the other is Kelty Hearts. So it takes a little bit of digging to try and find something that hopefully, if I find interesting, hopefully the audience will find interesting. I've got information about how they're doing that season, how they did last season compared to last season, future fixtures, efficiency at home, efficiency away. Information on the managers, the times they faced the other club, have they faced the other manager, when they've been head-to-head in their career, be it playing or be it, you know, as managers. So I did Philippe Clément's first game. And, you know, and I discovered that in, I think, one of his games, he'd played against Neil Lennon former Celtic manager in one of his last games for Coventry. You're just looking for little links that people might find interesting. So I gather all of that. I'll have all, for every player, I'll have their age, height, previous clubs, previous appearances this season, last season, total for their career with that particular club, so you can mark milestones. And then I'll take two or three little notes about players. You know, if it's Lauren Shankland, you know, he scored in 8 of his last 10 games. If it's players who are strikers but are on a bad run, it might be 10 games without a goal. But 6 of those 10 appearances might have been off the bench, so you try and set it in context. Basically, you're trying to prepare so you've got all of this mound of information. And the idea is that you use the right amount at the right time. It's having everything there. You know, I don't go into wanting to use every 100, 150 pieces of information I've got. I just want to use the right thing at the right time.
And it's not, I mean, it used to be a kind of solitary pursuit when you started out. It was you going to the game, but now you have to work along with a former member of football in some capacity as your co-commentator. Have you had any, I know you're going to be able to answer this because you've already told me which out of the two children you can nominate quite easily. Have you got a favourite co-commentator to work with?
It's a difficult question because there are so many great people that I've worked alongside. I think what you do is you start to establish relationships with people. And it can just depend on who you're working with. You know, one of my favourite guys to work with was Craig Patterson, the former Rangers and Hibs player. Craig had an understanding not just of football, but had a real understanding of the broadcast and what you were trying to achieve and the job of the commentator, you know, when to stay quiet. Ian McCall and I worked together quite a lot, and Ian, admittedly, you know, just would wander up and sit down and kind of let's go. And after a wee while working together, you know, we'd be chatting before the game, we'd talk about, you know, if the game goes in this direction and makes it almost dead, if it was a European tie, you know, what are we going to talk about? Where are we going to go? And Ian really developed a really keen understanding of, he wasn't just there to add his expert opinion, he was there to be part of the broadcast team. And he really got into that side of it. But I've worked with so many great people. We have Gordon Smith, Murdo McLeod, Billy Dodds, Stevie Cowan was probably the most underrated person I've worked alongside. There's just been so many. I like working with James McFadden. You know, James is good fun. Willie Miller is one of my favourites. People say to me, Willie's quite dour. Willie's actually a really funny guy. And I like to think that when I work with Willie, we're on a similar wavelength, that we can niggle each other slightly, you know, just to get the best out of each other. It's been a real privilege to work alongside these guys. I'll tell you what, Ian, the day I realised they were on a different level is I asked to go through to the BBC on the day that Rangers were playing against Leeds at Elland Road. Hearts were playing in Belgium. And I knew that the television feed was coming into the studio. So I asked to go along so I could watch the Hearts game. And they let me do so. So I was sitting in the studio with Gordon Smith. And while the Hearts game was off, you know, I was watching the Rangers game with him. And he was just pointing various things out to me. You know, if you watch this guy, he'll make this run here. He'll do this. Look at how he's playing that ball. And it just, all of these guys help you to see the game at a different level because all of them do. I understand the broadcasting side of it. I'm there. And Alistair Alexander told me this. You're there as the broadcast professional. Be the broadcast professional. These guys are there because they understand the game better than you. They can see it better than you. And one of your jobs is to make sure you can get that information out so you can share that with the audience. But all of these guys, they've all had that in common, is they do see the game at a different level. They're miles ahead of us.
Well, on the kind of counter side, have you had any co-commentators that have been absolute nightmares to work with?
I've had a few who have been what you would class as indisciplined.
I was hoping you were going to say Stevie Cowan, but you've
no, no. I'll put Stevie in the nice pile. He's a good lad. I've had a few commentators, you know, co-coms that, you know, and it's like you've got to keep quiet because I've got to talk at this point. You know, I understand you're excited, but, you know, you've got to keep quiet at that point. And you basically, you can have that chat. I mean, the worst cold call I ever had was in a different sport. I had it in rowing and the guy was a complete nightmare. And it turned out that he actually wanted to be the commentator and was not happy that this football guy had been brought in to commentate on rowing when he was the rowing expert, and he didn't like his role as the co-comm. So that caused a little bit of fun.
Can I understand what kind of egos and I suppose working in the background, but I think one question that fans will probably want to ask, when you're on an away trip, like you're doing one of the big international tournaments, you're doing Scottish teams in Europe, do you socialise with the co-commentators? Do you head out for an evening meal with them, kind of get some sort of relationship?
Yeah, I mean, I've been very... I know where you're going. What is the old saying in the Scottish press? If you're not in bed by 10 on a European trip, you just go back to your hotel. I think that's the saying. But no, you do get a chance to go out and, you know, have a chat. So I was in Florence last year or year before with Craig Levine. And Craig and I arrived, we flew out together.
The city of Florence.
Just in case. And, you know, we went out for a nice meal on the day before the game and after the game itself. You know, it was lovely just to get out and have a chat. And, you know, it's good fun. It depends. Sometimes it depends where you are. I mean, when I used to cover the Scotland games, you were usually out on the same flight as the players. The whole press would travel together. So you would then get the bus from the hotel, you know, from the airport to the hotel. So you'd be in a much more central place. So you did tend to go out as a press pack, if you like. Sometimes broadcasts would splinter off. But by and large, there were many, you know, really good nights out with the Scottish press pack. A little bit more different now because there's not as many people getting sent to games for money reasons. Teams tend to travel on their own. If they've got spare seats, they tend to sell them to corporate guests rather than the press. So you tend to find that the press are going out in different ways through different airports, traveling at different times. So there's a little bit of, I kind of miss that because it was always nice to go out with a group of journalists and things. You know, a lot of the journalists, and you'll know this, are just decent guys, you know, and they're in their good company over, you know, over a steak and a pint and just in having a chat.
Well, you get a lot of access behind the scenes, Paul, as we've kind of talked about. Can you think of any moments that you've seen the power of good that football can do rather than the kind of the excess that's maybe associated with the game now?
I think when you travel to some of these Eastern European cities and you see that the problems that they've had or, you know, and that sport can actually alleviate even just for a little while some of the bad. You know, I was in Bosnia when Hearts were there. And, you know, you're wandering through the town and, you know, there's buildings shut off because they're unsafe. You can see the bullet holes that are in these buildings. And it does take things a little bit more into perspective, but you can also see that, you know, people can then rally around their local institutions, you know, be it the church, be it club groups, be it football. And you can see the things that people start to do. You know, look at Hibs, who supported Dnipropetrovic, you know, the Hibs kids, you know, that came out of a visit over there. So there is a lot of good that can be done both here and abroad. And you can understand, you know, I mean, we do see too much of the, you know, the top flight in England and the excesses of wages and the prices. And, you know, football is now going to be split into the marquee and the art house. You know, and that's how it's going, and I don't see it stopping. There is going to be football at that really commercial Marvel level, and then there's going to be clubs that are more dear locally to people.
Yeah, I agree with you. Now, certain commentators, if you say their name, you'll immediately associate them with a goal. So you see Kenneth Wolvesenholme, Martin Tyler, immediately the phrase pops into the head of fans. What is the goal that they associate with Paul Mitchell in commentary?
I think the most I see that comes back so often as the McFadden goal in Paris. That seems to come up on an annual basis, where Scotland were playing in France, having already, did Gary Caldwell, I can't remember which way around the two games were. But I think both those goals, the Caldwell goal at Hampden against France to beat France, but the McFadden goal, I think just because the sheer unexpected nature of it. And that's one that people will often talk to me about, how did that feel? And there was no scripted line. There was absolutely nothing. Occasionally you can have an idea of what you might say, if Scotland win in France tonight, how are you gonna play it? But you don't take that as seriously because you think, well, we're probably not gonna do so. You think if he scores, will I say such and such? You might be aware if it's a 25th goal or a first goal or something. But the McFadden goal, I think, just left everybody breathless at the time. And I went with, he tickles the top corner and Scotland are tickled pink in Paris. And I've no idea where that came from. It's not a phrase I particularly use, but that's what came out my mouth at the time. And a lot of people say they really loved it. So it must have hit home somewhere.
Well, what does the most important person think about it? What's Faddy's opinions on it? Has he spoken to you about it?
I did a game in the Champions League with James, and we hadn't really met each other. And it was in Rennes just a few years ago. I mean, we'd met in the passing. And I arrived at the hotel. I'll call it a hotel. I mean, that was probably a very generous description. And I met the third member of our team, Kerry Nidsan. And he phoned along to my room and he says, look, he says, I've just been in the bar. He says, but I'm going to bed. He says, I'm up early. But James is down there. I said, well, I'll go down and say hello. I said, I mean, famously, I don't particularly drink. But I'll go down and join him. And so I went downstairs and finally went, I'll get you a beer. I said, no, I'm just going to sit, chat with you for 10 minutes. 3.5 hours later, it was just tremendous. We just talked all things football. And the story I told him about that goal was, I mean, there's a lot around that game, but basically we flew back straight away to Scotland. So we drove back to the airport. We had to get on a little bus to take us to the plane. And some of the Scotland players were on the bus, including James. So I took out my programme and asked them to sign it because Richard Gordon had done exactly the same. So James signed the programme. I got home probably about 4 a.m. And I left the programme beside my eldest son's bed and told him to take it to school to show his friends the following morning. So he was the most popular, what would he have been, 8, 9, 10-year-old in school, because he had, from the night before in Paris, the signed match programme of the guy who smacked the ball in from 40 yards. That I loved because nobody else really could have done that. And it was just lovely to be able to say to my son, go and show off to your mates that you've got a programme from last night in Paris signed by the guy that scored the goal. It was great.
Well, you're a superstar in Scotland, Paul. Everybody knows you. You get restaurants welcoming you in. I'm sure there was no problems whatsoever for you getting into the stadium in France to cover that game.
I got thrown out of the stadium, effectively. The television pass that I had was for one area, I'll call it Area A, but actually our TV position was in Area B. And I'd gone up and down several times. We were there about 2.5, 3 hours before the game. And always saying hello to the security guy. And I nipped downstairs about half an hour to go, for a pee, as you've got to, because you never know as a commentator. And I walked back up and he stopped me and he sent me to position A. And I'm like, no, I'm in position B. I've been walking past you all day. Things got quite heated. I had to be led away for my own good. And I basically, it was the boss of BBC had spotted what was going on and he argued with the guy for me. I went downstairs, had to walk outside the stand, come in at a different entrance, climb across row upon row upon row upon row upon row of seats to get to my commentary position. But the nice thing, Ian, on the way out, the security guard was still there And I gave him a wee cheery Scottish Alex Marshall style wave on the way out just to say thank you. And I thought that was the least I could do.
I think kind of everybody in press circles has some sort of experience like that. So I think the kind of frustrations are kind of shared with your collective kind of brethren. But you're not only star of the radio, star of television. You became star of the silver marketing screen, appearing in a Nike commercial. You're going to have to tell us how that came about.
Well, star's taken it too far, but so basically, I got a phone call. I had an agent who was looking for voice work for me. And he phoned me one Tuesday and he says, look, can you get down to London tomorrow? And this was the first piece of work first audition he'd got for me. He said, you need to go down there. There's some company auditioning for a football commentator. So I managed to get the train travel done. And I went down to a casting company in Soho. And I walked in and there was three types of people there, Ian. There was guys of my age, a little bit younger, a little bit older, but all sort of similar. There were girls in red dresses. And there were what I would call handsome devils. And it turned out the handsome devils were there to try out for a commercial for a razor company that included a girl in a red dress. And all us ugly ones were there to audition for the football commentator. I went in and I was paired up with this guy from Liverpool. And they said to me, okay, what you've got to do is you've got to imagine this football match, the weirdest football match you've ever been in, the most wild football match. You know, it's just talk through it. Tell us about it. Tell us what you think. And we'll count you in. We'll go 3, 2, 1. And I was just about to start. And the guy just jumped in straight away. I mean, he just right away jumped in and he talked a whole pile of complete and utter nonsense. So he then threw to me as if I was a co-commentator. He gave me a line, which I then ignored. And then I just started commentating as if I was commentating on football. Now, this guy was hopeless. He was pretending to be a football commentator, but I was a football commentator. You know, and it was dead easy. You know, I think one of the lines that I'd worked out is that Messi had never looked so tidy, which I thought was quite a nice little line. A bit cheesy, but, you know, not a bad line. So we came out and I phoned my agent and I said, that was great fun, really enjoyed it. I'll come home, they'll obviously give it to an actor. I got a call back the following week and I went in and I went in with another guy. And then they sent him out and they brought someone else in with me. So it turned out they were auditioning me with other people. And I'm thinking, I've got this. So I came out and I phoned my agent. I said, look, I've got this. He says, nah, this is not how it works, you know. And sure enough, 2 days later, he phoned with the news that I'd been given the gig. I was to fly to Barcelona. He still didn't know the name of the company. And it was about another week before I found out it was Nike. But I had to sign a non-disclosure agreement about the filming, about going to Barcelona. And it was weird. It was the weirdest thing I've ever done. We filmed it in Espanyol Stadium at midnight till about 4 a.m. And it was weird. It was wonderful.
Did you get anybody from out with the world of football that recognised you through the commercial?
I think what followed, when the commercial dropped, one of my neighbours ran along and rang my doorbell and went, have I just seen you in a Nike commercial? I'm like, was I on the screen? He went, yeah. He says, I could see you. He goes, why? I said, well, there was two different fees. There was one if I was out of vision, there was one if I was in vision. And the in vision one was much, much, much higher. So that's where I learned I was getting my higher fee. So, because I hadn't usually seen the advert by that point. I got a couple of bits in the newspapers and stuff, Ian, but it was a nice thing to do.
It certainly explains a question I've always had, because any time I see you at a game, Paul, you're wearing a pair of Nike or Jordans and you've also got a Nike sweatband on your head. So that explains that certain...
It was a very, very nice piece of work. I'll leave it at that.
You're certainly not a musician with just one fiddle. you've expanded into other sports with your commentary work. What other sports have you cast your spade into? If that's not a mixed euphemism, probably
the ones I do more often, Ian, I do a lot of rugby. I've been fortunate enough to do bowls, both indoor and outdoor, and I've done two Commonwealth games in Glasgow and Birmingham, which were just the most fun I think I've ever had in broadcasting, working with the team for the best part of 2 weeks. It was just tremendous. I've done various things, ice hockey, hockey, curling, shinty. The latest one was basketball. BBC Scotland are doing a bit of basketball at the moment. And I was asked to lead their coverage from a commentary perspective on that. So we did a test broadcast at the weekend, and we go live with a couple of games next month.
Nice. That'll be pretty good. That kind of leads into the next question, which I actually know the answer to. But what's the kind of dream job or event that you would like to do?
You know what? I mean, I would like to try and cover both baseball and the NFL. I mean, both sports that I absolutely love and adore. Baseball's really hard. It's a bit like cricket commentary. You've got to have all the stories, the back knowledge, you know. You've got to be able to fill in because the action, you know, is a little bit slower. I love listening to baseball commentary because a lot of the people who do it are just brilliant. The NFL, I'd like to try because it's, you know, it's a bit more like what I do in terms of football or, you know, basketball, something like that. You know, I'd like to work with somebody very knowledgeable and just to see if I could apply the same principles from football and rugby into that. So I'd love to give that a go. I doubt either will happen, but hey, we've got to have dreams somewhere along the way.
Well, the fact that you're doing basketball, Paul, one of the four American pillars.
I've done ice hockey as well.
Ice hockey,
yeah,
as well. You said, didn't you? So I mean, there's the way the kind of sports world is working now. We may one day see baseball or the MLB or NFL in Scotland, and they may want somebody local to do something.
I certainly wouldn't say no, that's for sure.
And I think a dream is maybe the best adjective to describe getting a chance to speak to you, Paul. That brings us to the end of another episode. My thanks to the erotic tones of Paul Mitchell. Join us next week for another forensic journey into the annals of Scottish football. Our website is at csi.com, where you can find all our socials. And until next week.
My pleasure, Ian. Always a pleasure. We can go back to hating each other now, I trust.